Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And welcome. Happy Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom. Hope you're having a great day and you're going to have a very safe Memorial Day weekend. It's, by the way, just a quick heads up, June 12th through the 14th, the Campaign for America's Future, their website, ourfuture.org, O-U-R-future.org, is putting on the Take Back America 2006 conference. A number of great speakers are going to be there. I will be doing this radio program live from the conference on Monday and Tuesday, June 12th and 13th. And you can get more information about the conference over at ourfuture.org. Give them a call, send them a note, whatever, and it's all there right on their website. It's the first hour of our Friday program when we usually talk with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives, the congressman from Vermont, running for the United States Senate from Vermont. His website, bernie.org, and I encourage you to check it out. Lots of great news there and information, plus stuff about Bernie's campaign for the Senate and what's going on. And Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie.
If you hear an echo in the background, we're talking from Burlington International Airport. Just got off the plane.
There you go. Yeah, and it's not always the very best phone line, but we'll make do with it. The immigration bill passed the Senate yesterday.
It passed the Senate. This is an extremely interesting issue and an important issue. It's bringing strange bedfellows together. Let me talk about what my concerns are. Number one, when you talk about immigration, we have to ask the question, why millions and millions of Mexican people want to flee their own country and come into the United States. It takes us to the Mexican economy. And, Tom, you know what else it takes us to? That issue of NAFTA. Remember NAFTA?
Oh, yeah.
And we were told when NAFTA was passed, this free trade agreement, that it was going to spur on the Mexican economy. It was going to prevent people from wanting to leave their country. In fact, the opposite is true. Poverty has increased in Mexico, and we're seeing more and more people wanting to flee from their own country. That raises whole questions about our trade policies and who it works for. NAFTA certainly has not worked for low-income people in Mexico and the working people of that country. Second of all, the issue of border security. We're paying a lot of attention to it now, but it is interesting to ask why, when so many illegal immigrants have been able to enter this country, so little attention has been paid to border security and the obvious failure of our border security. And I would argue that one of the reasons is that for many employers in the United States, they welcome illegal immigrants because they can pay them low wages and minimal benefits, and those workers have very little rights.
Right. They can intimidate them as well.
They can intimidate them. And when we look at our whole immigration policy, we have to ask ourselves what the goal is. Is the goal simply bringing in low-wage workers so that employers can exploit those people, or should our immigration policy be built around making us, as it has always been, a strong immigration policy, making us a stronger country? So one of the questions I think we all have got to look at is the impact of immigration on wages in this country. And I'm particularly concerned about this H-1B visa situation, because many people will be surprised to know that within the midst of this immigration debate, people think, well, we're talking about farm workers, we're talking about people doing jobs that many Americans, in fact, do not want to work at. But the truth of the matter is the Senate bill increases H-1B visas for skilled workers from 65,000 to 115,000 annually, and it would allow that number to go up. And then the question we have to ask ourselves is, why is it that we need to bring into this country as immigrants engineers, doctors, people who have graduate degrees, and why are we not, as a nation, training people to do that important, skilled, and well-paid work? Very important issue that I think is not getting the kind of attention that it needs. In any case, the Senate passed a bill, which is very different than the House bill. We will see what happens, if anything, as it goes to conference committee. And that's an issue that I'll be watching very, very strongly. In the midst of all of that, we have some 10, 12 illegal immigrants in this country. We should not be falling prey to xenophobia, racism. We have to treat people with respect. People came into this country, fled their own country out of desperation. They are not the people, in a sense, that we should be blaming. How we deal with that and the details of that will be very much what will everybody will be focusing on.
Enron. We have Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling just got nailed, but they were only punished. They were only convicted for crimes against corporations. Do you think that there's any chance that Enron itself? I mean, there are still assets there. There were also Enron had co-conspirators, you know, big banks and things, utility companies and whatnot. That the people who have been harmed by Enron might ever have a chance at getting something back.
It'd certainly be the right thing to do. As you know, people lost their pensions. People lost who worked for Enron lost so much. People did not have the opportunity to sell the stock as the stock was declining. I mean, people were really hurt very badly. And I would hope very much that as the process proceeds, those people would be able to get damages so they can help put their lives together again. One of the interesting things that took place on Capitol Hill didn't get a lot of media attention is a hearing that took place in the committee that I'm on called the Financial Services Committee, which was pushed by Congressman Bonnie Frank of Massachusetts. And that looked at the issue of executive salaries. And that is an issue that I feel very strongly about. I think it's been highlighted recently, as I'm sure you're more than aware of, Tom, by a fellow named Lee Raymond, who is former CEO of ExxonMobil. Here's a corporation that enjoyed $36 billion in profits last year, more than any corporation in world history. And while they're charging Americans $3 a gallon or more for gas, they managed to come up with a $398 million retirement benefit for him.
We have an official Lee Raymond alert on this program, Bernie. Would you like to hear it?
Sure.
Come here. I'm going to eat you. I'm bigger than you. I'm higher in the food chain.
That's Mike Myers' character, Fat Bastard, from the movies, you know, the Austin Power movies, who bears an uncanny resemblance to Lee Raymond.
Well, what we wanted to do on the committee is invite Mr. Raymond to the committee to explain to us why, when gas is now over $3 a gallon in many parts of the country, he thought he really absolutely needed a $398 million retirement package. But it's not just Raymond. It's not just ExxonMobil. Many corporations, oil companies in particular, but many others. We're seeing at a time when these corporations are cutting back on the pensions and the health care of their workers. They're giving their CEOs outrageous compensation packages, retirement packages, and interestingly enough, the stockholders of various corporations increasingly have very little to say about that. Those decisions are made by boards. The boards are pretty insulated and kept away from popular control of the stockholders. But the whole issue of the fact that right now in America, you have CEOs earning over 400 times what their workers are making. At a time when the middle class is declining and at a time when poverty is increasing, is an issue that we should focus on. In America, it seems to me, we should not be proud that we have by far the most unfair distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. I don't know that that's what this country was supposed to be about, with the richest 1% owning more wealth than the bottom 90% and, you know, the wealthiest 1/100 of 1% of families earning more income every year than the bottom 20 million. And that gap is growing wider and wider. And that's just not an economic issue. It's not just on saying, gee, it's not right that some people have so much. It becomes a political issue because these folks, with all of their money that contribute to the candidates of their choice, to the parties of their choice, to perpetuate their needs and represent their needs, while the middle class and working families have very little representation. And so it deals not just with economics, but what happens to the political life of this country, to the media life of this country. To my mind, it is a very serious issue.
Mm-hmm. Clearly. And why not just go back to the kind of tax policies that we had under the Eisenhower administration, that Dwight Eisenhower was an advocate of, by the way, the Republican president, of, you know, it's fine if you want, on your first $5-6 million a year in income, you know, you pay a pretty much, you know, the top end of the upper middle class income tax in today's dollars, $5 or $6 million. But beyond that, it goes up to 90% income tax.
Because right now, the people who run this country are very heavily motivated, not by the public good, not by democracy, not by a concern for their neighbors, but by greed. I mean, after all is said and done, Tom, and you, I know, or at least, have written some psychology, the question really does arise why people need hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to fulfill their lives.
Mm.
But greed is the word, and obviously, not only do they not want to go back to anything that smacks of a progressive income tax, they want to make it every day less and less progressive. That's what Bush has been doing. They want to repeal the estate tax, which only benefits the very wealthiest people in this country. So in many ways, in terms of distribution of wealth and income, we're moving in exactly the wrong direction.
Congressman Bernie Sanders with us at 16 minutes past the hour. His website, Bernie.org. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States. We'll be taking your calls right after this break, 866-440-8466-440-THOM. Your calls for Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment on the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So hey, there's a new American way. No one's serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. Watch the Sunshine State, how the scales got tipped to seal Al's fate. Jeb Bush winked, I told you so.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment every Friday. Congressman Bernie Sanders' website, Bernie.org. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Put you on live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Scott in San Diego, California, you're up first.
Good morning, Bernie and Tom. Bernie, I've been donating to Francine Busby here in San Diego because for a while the DCCC wasn't supporting her, so I was donating directly to her. When you said find independent candidates that you admire and support them financially, I thought, hey, great advice, I'm going to continue doing this. Not too long ago, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was reading an article online, I apologize, I can't find it again, that said when I donate to an independent candidate, approximately 20% or as much as 20% goes to a commission for the media buyer. So I called Francine's office and asked her the same question, and I got an answer here from her. But Bernie, what's your approach on this?
20% of your contribution goes to what?
A commission to the media buyer.
I think I know what's going on here, Scott and Bernie. And Bernie, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I used to own an ad agency down in Atlanta, and we never did political campaigns, but we certainly did a lot of commercial campaigns. And you usually, if you're going to buy media, radio, television, or whatnot, you go to an ad agency because you want them to develop the ad. And in exchange for developing the ad, sometimes they take payment for that. More often than not, they simply take a 20% or 15%. Usually it's 15. It was 15 when I was in the business in the 90s. 15% commission, and that's how the agency gets paid. That's not. I don't see that as a bad thing, Scott.
But and it's but Tom explained is right. Yeah, it's an expensive proposition to do ads, and that's the money that these guys get.
Well, what got me was that the DCCC and the DNC supposedly only spend a 1.7% commission. Francine Busby, by the way, says in her response to me, says she's spending 3.5% of the contributions go to the media buyer, 70% of the donations go directly to the purchase of TV commercials.
Well, they're both pretty incredible deals.
I think we're talking about different things. I mean, I think we're talking about what percentage of somebody's revenue coming in goes to this, goes to that. But when you place a TV ad or a radio ad, if you're working with the people who do it, as Tom indicated, there is a price to be paid for that.
Thank you.
And there's really just no way around that. I mean, they're the people who know how to do it best. Usually they get you deals, too, that more than make up for their own commission. Mitch in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Mitch.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. Good.
My comment is regarding Bush's treating of the Mexican immigration problem. I find it to be offensive in two ways, what he's proposing and what he's doing and what he's saying, in that, one, he's belittling the Mexican-American and the Mexican immigrant by saying that they're willing to take a lower-paying job because that's all they can do, or because that's all the law will allow them to do, since they're doing it illegally. And I find it offensive to Americans when he's saying that they won't take the jobs he thinks they won't take them because they're not good enough for them. But I think that Americans won't take those jobs because the employers aren't willing to pay a decent wage, give decent benefits. I guarantee you there's a lot of Americans that are legal and legal immigrants that would be more than happy to take those jobs if they were paying properly, if they had proper benefits. I think he's insulting both Americans and Mexicans by his comments.
Well, I tend to agree with you. I think in some respects, perhaps primarily in agriculture, there are jobs where we need a lot of help on. But I think that there are many other jobs that Americans would be more than delighted to take if the pay were decent and, as you indicate, if the benefits were decent. And as I mentioned earlier, and I think we should all be mindful of this, when you have institutions like the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is an extremely right-wing group of people, talking about their love of immigration, you have to keep your ears open and understand what that means. So that means the reason they love this is it drives wages down. It creates conflict between people, very, very poor people who work for almost anything, against American workers who expect a higher standard of living. So this issue of the role of immigration on driving wages down is a very important issue that needs to be discussed.
Okay. Julian in Seattle. Julian, we have about a half a minute. A quick one here, and maybe Bernie can answer it on the other end.
Yeah, I just wanted to address one thing. When the Wall Street Journal likes cheap labor, they're not just liking it because it creates strife or because it's creating class warfare. Cheap labor does one thing. It holds down prices, which also holds off inflation. And the only tool that the Fed really has to fend off inflation is raising interest rates. Now, if you look at where most of the money is in our economy, it's actually in family homes. And mortgages. And a lot of families are locked into these 5-in-1 ARMs. So if you start raising interest rates, you're going to be driving people out of their houses. If you collapse the housing market, you're really taking a huge bite out of the American pie.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle, Julian. Well said, and we'll get Bernie's comment on that when we come back from the break. Where it's our weekly hour with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. 27 minutes past the hour. Bernie.org, the website, our number 866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half to see them. No, 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 don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone. It'd be a paradise.
And welcome back to the program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our segment here, our regular Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, Bernie.org, his website, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 866-440-8466. Michelle in Long Beach, California on the line. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Tom. Nice to hear your voice on the phone again.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask Congressman Sanders, if he had been aware of this bipartisan bill in the House Judiciary Committee for net neutrality that it passed, and if he was aware of net neutrality and understood the importance of it?
Yep. The answer is a brief yep. It is a very important issue. I think the net is one of the new opportunities that we have in this country to allow a broad discussion of ideas and issues and cultural types of activity that is not under the arm of big money interests and those people who control the media. And obviously we have to be, it is today a reasonably democratic institution. Anybody can put up a website and communicate with people all over the world, and we have to be very, very vigilant against those big money interests who want to control it for their own purposes.
Well said. Pat in Atlanta, Georgia, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, how you guys doing? It's an honor to be able to talk to you today, Mr. Congressman.
Thank you, Pat.
I have a comment and a question. My comment would be the discussion earlier at the top of the show about the idea of any kind of government control over wages, whether they be outrageous or not, to, you know, which is a matter of opinion. But if a company wants to pay somebody $400 million, they have the freedom to do that, and I completely oppose the government involved in that process at all.
Pat, let me jump in and suggest to you it's not the government that we are talking about dealing with that issue. It is the stockholders of the company. And what we're seeing increasingly, you know, when one thinks about the people owning stock in a company, what we often hear is, well, it's the stockholders who really control the company. They don't like the way the CEO is operating. They can get rid of the CEO. They can elect different people to the board. Increasingly, that is not the case. And what we're seeing and what this hearing was about is the fact that stockholders are the people themselves, not stockholders, I'm sorry, people on the board themselves and CEOs have enormous power over who else gets on the board and then who determines what CEO salaries are about. And stockholders themselves have very little say about that. And I think that, in fact, is wrong.
Well, you know, that the ins and outs of the company is the company's business, as far as I'm concerned. That's just my opinion. That's fundamental belief. Sir, have you heard of H.R. 25?
Well, there are about 10,000 bills there. You'll have to explain what H.R. 25
is. Okay, H.R. 25 is income tax reform for a national retail sales tax. Will you support a national retail sales tax?
Yeah. Well, in general, I'm not supportive of those type of taxes because they're regressive. They ask people who purchase a product to pay the same in taxes regardless of the income of that person. I think that's kind of regressive. I would be much more sympathetic to a progressive income tax, asking those people who have more money to pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes.
Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Good afternoon. How are you, Congressman?
Good, Rick.
Forgive me if someone else brought this up, but I just tuned in. I wondered what your take was on the concern that Speaker Hastert was expressing regarding the raid into Congressman Jefferson's office. You know, it's kind of unusual for a Republican to stand up for a Democrat. I don't know if the man is guilty of anything, and I don't think Congressperson should be, you know, above the law. But I am concerned about the issue of separation of powers here. Do you think there was any violation of the separation
of
powers?
Yeah, I do. And, Rick, you raise an interesting question. What I found interesting and amusing is that at a time when millions of Americans have expressed concern about the USA Patriot Act, people have expressed concerns about NSA wiretapping, more recently about the collecting of millions of people's phone calls in Washington, D.C., we didn't hear much of a response from the speaker, but I am glad that he spoke out on this issue because the issue has nothing to do with the alleged guilt or innocence or whatever the case may be with Congressman Jefferson. Charges have been made against him. Those charges have got to be pursued. An investigation has to take place. He's going to be tried by his peers, and if he's guilty, he's guilty. The issue here, as you indicate, very important precedent, and that is the separation of power. Does the executive branch, the administration, have the right to come in and raid a congressman's office? And I would be very, very concerned about that. I was glad to see the speaker, who is a Republican, speaking out in opposition to that raid, although it was a Democrat's office who was raided. The president of the United States today has a very broad sense, an imperial sense, I would argue, of what he can do. And I think he's got to be reined in. He is not a king. He is a president. He cannot do anything he wants at any time. Just as it would be wrong, for example, for the Capitol Police, the police who operate under the authority of the U.S. Congress, to raid the White House if the Congress wanted information from the White House. I think you're in for very bad things. So I support what Denny Hastert said on that issue.
Bernie, I find it curious that you had Tom DeLay, who's actually been indicted by a grand jury for a felony, and nobody wanted to search his office. You had Duke Cunningham, who was indicted, convicted, confessed to a felony. They didn't want to search his office. You've got all these folks who are associated with Abramoff, all these Republicans who are taking money from Abramoff. Nobody's wanted to search their offices. I mean, there's even a murder in Florida that seems to be involved in this thing. And then a Democrat gets involved, only that Democrat is the victim of a sting operation. You know, apparently the FBI set this thing up from the get-go. So, A, you've got, you know, sting operations, and B, it's a Democrat, and all of a sudden, oh, we got to search his office. Am I being paranoid?
Maybe.
Okay.
The answer is I don't know, and that's what we'll have to see. But the point is, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, the more important point here is the principle of the separation of powers.
Yeah.
Whatever Jefferson's situation may or may not be, and we'll find out eventually, he has to go through a whole process, you do not want the White House to be raiding congressional offices. Today it's Jefferson, tomorrow it could be something else. Who made that phone call? Who was involved in that demonstration, Mr. Congressman? What role did you play? We're going to raid your office. Very bad precedent, I think.
Right, or vice versa, having Congress raid the White House. You wouldn't want that either. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Armin, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie. Bernie.
How are you?
Fine. Hey, help me with this fuzzy math. Jeb Bush is going out as governor at the end of this term this year, and he's been in for 8 years. When he went in, the state Florida budget was approximately $25 billion. It's now well over $71 billion. Fees for licenses went through the roof. All kinds of other fees and stuff, exorbitant. Local sales taxes and property taxes have went through the roof. Home insurance has tripled. You can't get health insurance. It's out of sight.
What's your point, Armin?
The point is, they're sitting there in the Republican media last night and almost made me throw up. They're saying, well, he cut taxes $19
billion. Mm, okay. Bernie.
Well, I mean, one way that politicians, you know, I was a mayor for 8 years. A lot of things you can do. You can lower taxes by cutting back on government services, and then people end up paying more out of their pocket in fees and tolls and you know, goodness knows what else. So I'm not an expert on Florida politics or the government of Florida, but certainly it is not unheard of that people end up paying more out of their own pocket despite the fact or because of the fact that government services have been cut.
Tony in the Bronx, New York.
Yes,
Tony?
Yes. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Tom and Bernie. I have a question. The Senate is supposed to take up the following week the measure, the discriminatory measure, in my opinion, to ban gay marriage, constitutional amendment. My question is, when is that supposed to come up in the House, and what is the likelihood of that being passed? Because what will it do? Will it revoke gay people who have been married? For instance, my partner and I were married in Canada last year, and civil unions and domestic partnership, if it was ever passed?
Well, I don't know the exact wording of it, but they're probably going to be... Are you talking about the constitutional amendment?
To ban gay marriage, not only gay marriage, but the second sentence, in the Senate resolution, bans civil unions and also domestic partnership.
Well, needless to say, I don't have the document in front of me. I think that that's a discriminatory act. It's something I certainly will vote against. I think these decisions are much better left up to the states in our country who have historically played that role. And I think, you know, to be very honest with you, what you're looking at is an election's coming up in 6 months. The Republicans are in a lot of trouble. The economy is not doing well for the middle class. Healthcare is disintegrating. Environmental policies, the war in Iraq, you know. So these guys have to look at certain issues that they can demagogue on and hopefully rally their base. And I'm afraid gay bashing will be one of them.
Gay bashing is coming back into fashion for the Republicans.
Simon, we can expect that.
Yeah, not that it ever went out of fashion for
right.
Republicans. 45 minutes past the hour. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment on the Tom Hartman radio program, where we run rings around the right wing 5 days a week, 3 hours a day. We'll be right back. Stick around, my friends. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good morning, America. How are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, bernie.org. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Toll-free across the United States. Dave in Des Moines, Iowa on the line. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
I'd like to push for a new concept. It's called a shuttle bus system in which it runs on E85 or hybrid engines. And basically, it would you can utilize the Internet in which if you want to have the bus on call, you can just sign up for it, and a GPS system will be involved in which when it's about a minute away from your house, it'll call your cell phone. But the idea is basically, especially like during around coastal areas where hurricane is, you know, is a problem, if you had enough of these shuttle buses and also extra lanes or certain lanes assigned just for evacuation, for example, you could get people out of there a lot faster, and also it would reduce global warming because you wouldn't be using as much oil, and plus we would reduce the dependency on foreign oil. And I just wanted to see what you think of the idea.
Sounds like an interesting concept. You're combining a couple of concerns of getting people out of disaster areas and protecting our environment.
Yeah, it is interesting. Artie in Detroit, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Senator.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, there's something you were talking about the Senate, the executive and the legislative doing battle, raiding each other's office. Here's another thing I haven't heard touched on. I'd like to hear your opinion on. If in 2008 you have a Republican running against a Democrat, the Republican and the present administration has access to information. Say the NSA recorded cell phone calls from every American into who they're talking to. Wouldn't it give one party an advantage over the other, and do you trust these people with this information? I mean,
well, yeah, obviously it would, and obviously we would hope and expect that that would never occur. I mean, what we're told is that the widespread collecting of telephone calls from millions and millions of Americans is that what is being collected is who they call, but not the content of the call, that the calls are not being tapped. But having said that, that itself is very valuable and important information. So I think that that practice is a very bad practice. We all know that we want to fight terrorism and protect the American people, but you don't have to do it in a way that breaks laws or undermines the Constitution of the United States. I'm on a lawsuit which would end that practice, in fact. So we want to move vigorously and make sure that our country remains a free country where people don't have to look over their shoulder or worry about who's listening to them or where their phone call information is going.
Well, and the fact of the matter is that the reason why the FISA law was passed and other similar laws that the Bush administration appears to be breaking right now is because Richard Nixon actually did use the CIA, the FBI, and the IRS for partisan political purposes.
I mean, look, let's not be naive. Once the information is there, it's stored, it's collected, it's on tape, of course it could be used.
Yeah.
But the other side of the equation is the FISA law gives the government strong mechanisms to investigate terrorists, which is what we want, but you do it with court warrants, you do it under the law and under the Constitution.
Diane in Olympia, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I've been supporting you all the way.
Well, thank you, but we've got a long way to go.
We're there for you here in Washington.
Thank you.
And sorry the checks keeping on coming. But I just wanted to say thank you to what I consider the hope lover that you make me be, and same with Tom, because yesterday on ABC News they had a program about President Chavez in Venezuela, and I guess they have a huge oil reserve down there, and they're trying to portray this man, Chavez, as a name caller of Bush and as somebody who is, you know, aligning himself with Cuba. But I don't care about Cuba. I care about the people down there who have suffered under these oligarchies, which Tom loves to talk about. And I think this has to be more educated and enlightened how we deal with Chavez and Morales, who I'm happy about.
Well, I think the point you're making is that if you look at American history, especially toward Latin America, there has never been a government that has stood up for the poor people, and so many people in Latin America are desperately poor that has not in one way or another been opposed by the United States government, or in fact been overthrown by the United States government, including Salvador Allende of Chile. So, I think that whatever the strengths or weaknesses of Chavez may be, it is very interesting how this government, our government, the Bush administration, responds to him. And yet when you have these right-wing governments, oligarchies, people who enrich themselves at the expense of poor people, there's never a word of concern, never a word.
He's kissing the Saudi princes and walking around holding their hands.
Right.
And,
and
these are the guys who every Friday, today is public execution day in Jeddah,
in
Saudi Arabia. They'll be out there beheading people in the stadium, and no problem with that.
You know, and that call touches on the broader issue of our relationship with the whole world, with the fact that there are so many people struggling to survive on a dollar a day, 50 cents a day. And if we are concerned, not only from a moral point of view of trying to uplift the poorest people in the world, but even from a self-interested point of view in terms of terrorism, we have got to make poor people all over the world understand and believe that we are on their side. We don't want their children dying of curable diseases. We want their kids to get an education. And when we do those things, we make people say, you know what, we love America, we respect America, America is helping us. That is probably the best thing that we can do in fighting Islamic fundamentalism and international terrorism.
As Alexis de Tocqueville said in 1836 in his book Democracy in America, America is great because she's good. When she ceases to be good, she will cease to be great.
Right.
Yeah. Congressman Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us.
Good
Bernie.
To be with you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. It's 56 minutes past the hour. Bernie.org, Bernie's website. Be sure to check it out. It's a valuable resource. 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least, you know, clean elections. We'd settle for that. We really would. We'll be back after the news. Stick around, my friends.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman radio program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. David Tebow is with us. He's the editor-in-chief at CNS News, the Cybercast News Service. CNSnews.com, the website. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
There's an article over on CNS News by Nathan Birchfield, if I'm pronouncing it right, who says he starts out, a conservative organization is encouraging Republican leaders in Congress to consider offering a tax deduction for gasoline consumption to help alleviate the strain of rising gas prices. Why? That's what he says. Here's my question. Why is there even a discussion about our tax dollars being transferred to big oil companies via tax breaks for consumers instead of being used to build an infrastructure for an efficient energy policy?
Well, I think we're going to agree for different reasons on why any kind of manipulation of the tax policy to accommodate higher gas prices is foolish. In this case, you're talking about the Council of Republicans for Environmental Advocacy. And in the aftermath of Bill Frist's flop of the $1,000 tax credit.
Which started out as $100 and then it went to $500.
Yeah, I mean, ridiculous.
Yeah.
This proposal is for some form of a tax deduction.
All right.
So that whatever you spent for gasoline, you could deduct and get, if you're in the 25% tax bracket, obviously you get 25% of that back. If you're in the 33% bracket, you get a third of it back. So if you spent $3,000 a year on gasoline, then you would get $1,000 back.
Well, and this is also a tax deduction, not a tax credit. So the more money you make, the more money you'll get back from the government. Those people who are the working poor, who are really being whacked by the gas prices, will get nothing because it's not a tax credit.
I think more accurately, the more money you spend on gasoline, you're going to get more money.
No, but somebody who's in a 5% income tax bracket is going to get nothing back from this thing.
True. But,
you know, if they're making $25,000 a year and they got a family of four, they're going to get nothing.
That's true, but they don't pay much tax in the first place.
But they're paying a whole lot for the gasoline, and that's what this
they
is intended to respond to. It sounds to me like this is just another tax cut for billionaires. For the upper middle class, actually.
It potentially is a regressive policy because, as you say, people who are already not paying any taxes, and you've got to emphasize that point, they're already not paying any taxes, would not benefit as much as people who are already paying a lot of taxes.
Mm-hmm.
True. But I think, Tom, that all of this is ridiculous, that it's an overreaction, just as we've seen a lot of overreactions, to a temporary situation. Let it shake out. A year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, the oil companies might be begging for assistance. And are we going to be willing to grant them assistance when they come calling? I mean, we're trying to punish them or try to give the average consumer some sort of break now because gasoline prices are high, but this is a commodity that goes up and down based on demand.
David Tebow, from the time John Rockefeller first made his, what in today's dollars would be billions, until this moment, I don't recall, and I'm a fairly decent student of history, any time when the oil companies came begging for anything.
Well, that's
you're saying
true.
That because it might happen at some point in the future, we should
that's not true. I mean, you know, in the 80s, when the oil business in Texas and Louisiana went bust, when oil was $10 a barrel, oil companies were in dire straits. And, you know, it could happen again. I mean,
you had some small oil companies that were not
are $75 a barrel now, but can you tell me with absolute certainty that 10 years from now oil prices won't be $20 a barrel or less?
I can't say it with absolute certainty,
but
the fact is that we are on the back end of peak oil in the United States. I mean, this is one of the things that was harming the oil companies in the 70s, was that it was more expensive for them to pump oil out of the ground in the United States because we were at the back end of peak oil than it was to import oil from overseas. And so the big oil companies, like Exxon, for example, were able to be very, very profitable during that time. And small, you know, family-owned oil companies in Texas throughout the United States, a lot of them in California as well, we're having a hard time, and they ended up being bought up by the big companies. But that still is no reason for us to say, oh, gee, we should cut these guys some slack.
Then why do you want to impose a tax on their windfall profits now when you're not going to be willing to help them out in dire circumstances?
Because I don't believe that they would be having windfall profits if they weren't monopolies.
What you want to do is tax a really profitable situation that they face right now.
Well, actually, what I want to do is break them up. I want to say these companies are behaving like monopolies. They are monopoly. You know, it looks like a duck. It quacks like a duck. It's a duck. These are monopolies. And they're behaving in ways that are contrary to the traditions of America. They're behaving in ways that destroy competition. They're part of a larger monopolistic system, the oil cartel system, which is also monopolistic. We can't do much about that. It's international. But we have basically four oil companies in the United States, whereas when Reagan came into office, there were 25
major
oil companies.
But you don't have many more telephone companies than that right now, Tom. And you know AT&T was broken up in the early 1980s to foster competition. It did temporarily, but now all of the telephone companies have merged again.
I know. It's a terrible thing. And it's a consequence of Republican policies. There was a time there when AT&T got broken up by Jimmy Carter where if you own stock in AT&T, your shareholder equity actually increased because you ended up with shares in all these Bell companies.
Baby Bell.
And it was a marvelous thing. It increased competition, and it also opened up the marketplace. And there was a time there, I was living in Vermont, and I had my choice of phone companies. I mean, they had to compete. The copper coming into my house was considered a public utility because it ran through the public rights of way. And most of it was put into place and paid for back, you know, 30s, 40s, and 50s anyway, with tax dollars. And it's certainly being maintained right now with tax dollars. But the year that I left Vermont, 2 years ago, the phone company, Verizon, as I recall, came in and said, okay, that's it. We're going to push through legislation. And I believe they did. I'm not sure if it finally passed. Push through legislation so that we don't have to sell, you know, on this copper. You can't have a competing phone company. Here in Vermont, there's only one phone company that I can get to provide me with telephone service. Period.
Mergers,
that's a monopoly again.
Mergers and acquisitions are part of the way Wall Street works. It's part of survival of the fittest of the corporate world. And if a corporation gets swallowed up by a larger corporation, one of two things happened. It either became so valuable that the other company offered it a price that it couldn't refuse, or it was sinking and got gobbled up because it had no other choice. And that's just the way our capitalist system goes. That's the
but it's not
of the corporate world, and that's what
it's not.
That's what you're seeing in the oil industry, as you've seen.
What you're describing is the nature of unregulated laissez-faire capitalism, David Thiebaud, and historically what Americans have said, starting in 1881 when we first got aggressive about it, but I would say you could go back to 1773 with the Boston Tea Party. What we have said is that when a corporation becomes so large that it is that it has the ability to manipulate politicians, it has the ability to manipulate our political process, that it has the ability to dominate a marketplace, that it becomes a monopoly, as Republican Senator Sherman from Ohio said in 1881 when he introduced Senate Bill No. 1 in December of that year, the Sherman Antitrust Act, when it becomes so large that it can dominate a market and freeze out competition, it is the obligation of we the people to save capitalism from itself.
Mm-hmm.
By
sure.
breaking up these monopolies. And,
but I don't think you have that situation with oil companies. You have
I think we absolutely
oil,
do. I don't think that's why the prices are so high, but I think that that's why the profits are so high.
Well, you have four major oil companies, so there's enough competition. Your solution...
They're not compete. Come on, David. I'm assuming you're old enough to remember back in the days when there were four different gas stations on four different corners all over America, and they actually competed and had price wars.
They do today.
Come on.
They absolutely do today.
I have two gas stations within 5 miles of my house.
In my neighborhood, there are gas stations right across the street whose prices go up and down based on the competition. Absolutely.
They're not going up and down based on competition. They're going up and down based on a wink and a nod that says, oh, you raised your price a penny? I'll raise my
That's
price a penny.
That's not true, Tom. That's not true. When one price is $3.09 and the gas station across the street lowers its price to $3.03, guess what happens? More cars go to the station with $3.03.
Right, and then the other station goes to $3.03 and we're back to where
we
were.
Well, that's called competitive pricing.
At the small retail level, and there are a few small retailers left.
Do you get your gasoline straight from ExxonMobil, or do you go to that small gas station?
I say that at the macro level, at the level of these four giant behemoth oil companies who are accumulating profits greater than the earth has ever seen. You know,
you
no
want
corporation
the government to run everything, Tom.
No, I don't want the government to run anything in the oil industry. Not at all. The government does define the rules of the game of business. And one of the rules of the game of business should be you don't get so big that you destroy the marketplace, that you're anti-competitive, that you're a monopoly.
Well, as I just pointed out, there's plenty of competition out there, and they're not destroying competition. They're not
Try and
abiding,
start an oil company.
They're not abiding by your view, your worldview of government control of everything.
Again, I'm not suggesting that there should be government control of everything. I'm saying we should be enforcing the laws that Republicans like Dwight Eisenhower and Barry Goldwater were all in favor of, the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Well, I don't have a problem with the Sherman Antitrust Act. I have the problem with you and liberals thinking
if it was
the government could solve all our problems.
Okay. David Thiebaud, CNSNews.com. Always good talking with you, David.
All right, my friend.
16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, if you want to, you got to run. Oh, maybe if you want to, maybe if you
want to. And welcome back, Tom Hartman, with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com as well, the website. You can get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, the Tom Hartman program. We dare to ask the questions the mainstream media is afraid of, such as, are the oil companies monopolistic? Are they sewing up the market? Are they behaving in a way that is anti-American, fundamentally anti-American? And is this the consequence of bad behavior on the part of the oil companies or bad behavior on the part of Ronald Reagan, who began this whole process of no longer enforcing the Sherman Act, which is my take on it? We'll get to your calls and more discussion on that and other news of the day. But first, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. I'm at the White House today. I'm not in Rayburn's office building.
And so, therefore, you're not locked down?
I'm not locked down, no. I'm down in the basement, though. That's where we have our office. We never see the light of day or anything else, actually.
Mm-hmm.
This is smaller than most people's toilets, this room.
Mm.
It smells slightly better, but not much.
Well, that's reassuring.
We only had a gaggle today. We did not have a press briefing. But one question which was asked was whether Speaker Hastert had spoken to the president since Hastert made the allegation that the Justice Department was out to retaliate against him. I thought it would be interesting to know an answer to that. No, he has not, we were told.
Is this like, has war been declared between the Republicans in the House and the White House?
Well, you kind of get that impression, but we're being given the impression that the president is really the peacemaker here, because it was the president's idea to seal the papers that were taken and to sort of soothe the way. I mean, apparently the president said what you need is time to reflect on this and figure out how to do it the right way.
Hmm.
He didn't want the issue to be forced at a time when tempers were fairly high.
Now, that all sounds very reasonable, but he did steal the papers in the first place, and he still has them. He didn't give them back. Here's the thing that I find fascinating about this. I've been predicting, Victoria Jones, for the better part of a year, that come November, the Republican Party is going to be not just given permission, but encouraged to run against George W. Bush, because Bush has become so toxic. And here in today's Wall Street Journal, let me just share two sentences with you, or three sentences. Scrambling to avoid termination, California governor ditches conservative 2005 script and tacks back towards center. In his campaign, led by former Bush strategist. Now, Bush is loaning people to Schwarzenegger.
Wow.
To run his campaign. Led by former Bush strategist, Schwarzenegger criticizes Bush on climate change, Medicare, and immigration. A new poll has shown that his approval ratings have gone up from 32% to 36%, this is Schwarzenegger, since he began criticizing Bush. Now, I've just been predicting all along that Bush does not want the Republicans to lose the House in 2006 because he knows that he will then be impeached. Karl Rove doesn't want the Republicans to lose the House because that will lead to investigations that will probably lead to his being imprisoned.
Right.
And the same for Dick Cheney will probably be facing criminal charges.
Right.
And so these guys will do anything to have the Republicans continue to hold the House, including helping the Republicans run against Bush. And so my prediction is that what we're going to see, that these are just the beginning of it, and that Bush is actually saying, oh, yeah, cool, pick on me. What do you think?
Well, I think it's possible. I think it's quite extraordinary that we're even having the conversation.
Yeah.
And that we're not stoned.
What do you mean? Oh, you mean that this is like, you know, if we had had this conversation 5 years ago, we would have said the only way we could have this conversation
yeah.
is if we were both tripping or something.
That this is real.
Yeah.
This isn't a film.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's quite possible, and I certainly think Karl Rove is capable of it, and from a political point of view, it's quite a good idea.
Yeah, this is in John Harwood's column, The Washington Wire, and I was the first sentences I read and the last one I was, you know, paraphrasing and patching, but yes, it seems to me like it's begun. The Republicans have figured out that the only way that they're going to make it is to run against Bush. And Bush has figured out that the only way he's going to survive politically is to let them, encourage them to run against him. In fact, even maybe provide them with some nice targets like his immigration support that they can yell about.
It's not a bad idea at all. It really isn't a bad idea at all. They certainly can't win by running with him.
That's political genius.
And what strategy do the Democrats have to go up against that, we ask?
That's all, folks. It's turning into a bad Warner Brothers cartoon here on the Democratic side.
Yeah, they are capable of losing even this.
You think so?
Yes, I do.
In November, yeah.
Yeah, I do think so.
I'm concerned that you might be right. We just have a few seconds left. Real quickly, anything else happening in Washington, D.C. this weekend that we
should
know about?
Nothing really. I mean, only the shots fired, if they were shots indeed, in the Rayburn House office building. That's the only major news. There's frankly nothing else going on.
You don't think there's going to be a Rove indictment handed down today by the grand jury?
Well, we're all talking about it downstairs in the basement of the White House. But we do that every Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Every Friday we talk about, is there going to be a Rove indictment? So we don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll stay in touch.
We live in hope.
There you go. Victoria Jones, our senior congressional correspondent. the talk radio.
Oh, news. That one now.
Okay. Yeah, well, we'll give you a different promotion every day.
Thanks.
All right, with the talk radio news service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls, 866-440-8466, and more right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's just time to pay the price. Not listening to advice. Deciding in your youth on the policy of truth.
And at the same time, that the oil companies are using a good chunk of their not inconsiderable profits to fund folks out there saying, there's no such thing as global warming. We need to drill in Anwar. Let's lobby for this. Let's push for that. At the same time that that's going on, University of Washington atmospheric scientists say the tropical regions on Earth are expanding, shifting weather-determining jet streams toward the poles and broadening the risk of desertification. That's the creation of deserts on planet Earth. They analyzed satellite temperature data from the lower atmosphere, the troposphere, collected between 1979 and 2005, and they found that the lower atmosphere in subtropical regions between 15 and 45 degrees latitude is warming faster than at the equator. This is going to push that would be the area. I don't have a globe in front of me, but my recollection is that would be subtropical. It would be like the central United States south down to the center of Central America, maybe. I shouldn't say it without looking at a globe. In any case, those regions are warming faster than the equator. This mid-latitude tropospheric warming, explained Kwang Fu, the colleague of this John Wallace, a University of Washington atmospheric scientist and one of the authors of the report in today's Science magazine. This mid-latitude tropospheric warming, this in an article by Tom Paulson in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, will push the jet streams toward the poles because these powerful currents of air are created where tropical warm air masses collide with colder air flowing down from the polar regions. So the jet stream changes. Deserts form. Wallace says, frankly, I don't see this paper as that central to the global warming debate, but he says it is a piece of the puzzle, and clearly the evidence is in need of resolution. So here we have another, you know, something's up. Something's up. At the same time that Al Gore is starting his movie, I guess it's opening in New York this weekend. It's going to be the end of June or first week of June here before it shows up here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, also known as Portland, Oregon. And so we're looking forward to that. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Tom, I think I caught you on the early part. You know, last night you subbed for Randy Rhodes.
Yeah.
And I think you had somebody from Ayn Rand on there.
I did. It was Andrew Bernstein.
Okay. And I thought you said something about it was immoral to try to interfere with Walmart or any corporate entity. And I'm just wondering,
yes,
can you use morality in regard to corporations as opposed to, I mean, there would be laws involved and business practices, but isn't morality reserved for, like, living things?
This is the realm, Karen, arguably it should be, this is the realm of philosophy that the folks whose thinking is driving the Grover Norquists and the George Bushes of the world and the other oligarchs and plutocrats around the world, that's providing them with a rationalization to return us to Victorian-era laissez-faire economics. And the foundational thought that the objectivists and libertarians and conservatives hold is that the highest moral value, the highest human moral value, is the ownership of property.
Woo.
The ability to own things. And therefore, because a corporation is property which is owned by its stockholders, and that corporation, you know, it should be able to buy land, buy property, and do whatever it wants in their worldview, because that's the highest morality. If a community says, no, wait a minute, we don't want you here, we don't want this corporation here, because of, you know, whatever reason, we don't want to be poisoned by your toxic waste incinerator or, you know, whatever, that that moral issue is subordinate to the moral issue of the ownership of private property. And my rebuttal to that, which has not yet sunk in, I keep arguing it with these guys, my rebuttal to that is that historically, most humans have not even owned property. I mean, you look at the way most indigenous and tribal people who are living the way humans have lived for hundreds of thousands of years, the idea of ownership of property is considered bizarre. The community owns the property.
Oh, would you say it's a really, really radical idea?
Yeah, I would say so. And in fact, I would say even today, community owns property. Here in the United States, for example, I own a house. Actually, I own a little piece of water in the river. On which my house floats, but I don't really own it. If I don't pay property taxes, then the city can come and take it away, or the state or the county, they can come take it away. And so really what I'm doing is I'm leasing it from the community at large. As long as we have property taxes, there is no actual ownership of property. There is rental of property, essentially. And what we're doing is, when we sell property, is we're transferring the lease. You know, we're selling the lease. And I would submit that we all have agreed to that because we all agree that the values of community, the things that are paid for with the property tax, largely schools, police, fire, things like that, the things that maintain community, the values of community are a higher morality than the values of private property. And that's where the debate really cleaves down to. That's the polarity of the debate that most people don't get, that conservatives believe that property, the ownership of property, which includes the ownership of wealth, trumps everything else in a moral universe, in a moral structure. And traditional American values, traditional liberal values, starting with Rousseau in the 1600s and John Locke in the late 1600s, early 1700s, the traditional liberal values, the values on which this country was founded, suggest instead that the highest moral value is the needs of the community, the needs of individual human beings within the context of society, not the desires, not the greed or the want or the set-aside need, not the wants of individuals. Is it making sense?
Yes, it is. I'll do a bit of research on those objectivists and what have yous.
Yeah. You can find out all about them at their website. I mean, AYNRAND.org, AyNRAND.org is, they have their information. And you want our information, my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, kind of lays this stuff out. Or just, you know, read the Founding Fathers, read Rousseau, read Locke, although to some extent Rousseau and Locke were kind of awakening out of the idea that property trumps everything else and the king owns all the property. I mean, that was the history. So the first step was, okay, the king owns all the property and property trumps everything else. And then the second step was, okay, property trumps everything else, but maybe the king shouldn't own the property. Maybe the people should. And then the third step was, okay, if the people own it rather than the king, we're talking community here rather than individual or family. And that means that the value of community is going to have to be elevated above the value of property. That John Locke in Second Treatise on Government, published in 1724, as I recall, wrote life about the highest value being life, liberty, and the ownership of private property. And Thomas Jefferson changed that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence. It was the first time that the word happiness had ever appeared in the founding document of any nation. And it was a revolutionary and radical departure. And it reflected the values of Americans and I think continues to, except for the Grover Norquist cons.
Thanks
for thought. Thanks for calling, Karen. Lynn in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is Lynn Landis.
Hey, Lynn.
The voting machine person.
Indeed. Ecotalk.org is your website, Lynn?
Yes, ecotalk.org. But I really called up to talk about your the idea of monopolies and what's going on in this country, because my husband was a Eastern Airline pilot for 17 years. And what I think a lot of people aren't sensitive to is the fact that our tax system encourages takeovers of one company over another.
Yes.
So here came Frank Lorenzo with Continental, a smaller, poor-funded airline, until they decided to take over Eastern Airlines. So they got a bunch of bankers or investors together, mm-hmm. and they not only took over Eastern Airlines, but they get to write off, you know, the interest payments on their taxes.
Right, as an expensive acquisition.
Right. So yeah. One week my husband would be flying an airplane, and for Eastern, and the next week he'd see it over at the Continental gate. I mean, they were simply shifting assets over. Now he works for Northwest, and guess who's gone bankrupt? It's the same thing. These companies get taken over by people who borrow the money to do it, and then they skim off all the assets.
This is what Kevin Phillips writes about in his new book, about how our economy has, the main driver of our economy now has shifted from the production of goods or the offering of services to arbitrage, basically, to moving money around.
Exactly.
And when that happens, you have an economy that is incredibly vulnerable.
Well, you know, this other sort of a conclusion I've reached about all of this, and it's definitely a radical one, is I think just like we have a minimum wage, we should have a maximum aggregate of income. I mean, all the income. Because I don't think democracy can afford to have a handful of people controlling all the wealth.
Well, it's not a radical idea. I mean, that's Teddy Roosevelt in proposing an inheritance tax was saying that. We don't want to have a landed gentry here in the United States. It's fine for people to become millionaires. It's even fine for them to become billionaires. But, you know, $40 billion, $100 billion, at what point do you have enough? For you and your family and your extended family forever. And what kind of impact does that have on society? I mean, you've got one guy, Bill Gates, who's got a net wealth that's greater than that of 40% of all Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a healthy thing for society? And society, these are questions that really need to be discussed. I'm not putting a flag in the sand here and saying this is the absolute where I'd draw the line. But we haven't had a discussion about this in the United States since the 1950s. And I think that it's time for us to have that discussion. The other one is an effective cap on income, and that being the 90% top marginal tax rate. So,
yes.
Lynn, thanks for the call, and thanks for raising the issue. As I said, I don't think these are radical issues, because what you would have found was from 1912, basically, you know, when Teddy Roosevelt really started talking about this stuff, through the 30s when Franklin Roosevelt put it into practice, and all the way up until the 60s and 70s, it was conventional wisdom in the United States. It wasn't until the 80s when Reagan started flipping this stuff upside down. 45 minutes on at past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Save me now, save me now, save me now. Save me now, save me now. One day the earth woke up and said, boy, it's getting hot. And remember all those trees I had. But now there ain't a lot. And my eyes kept slowly trickling down to where the party's at. And if everybody's going there, well, that's the end of that.
The place for being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. 9 minutes before the hour. 866-440-8466, our telephone number. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Expecting morality out of a corporation is like expecting it out of a shark. I mean,
well, the fact of the matter is that corporations are restricted by law. There has been a Supreme Court decision. There was one in the case of Ford versus, as I recall, it was the state of Michigan back in the 1950s that concluded that it was a Michigan State Supreme Court decision, that a corporation must... Yeah, it was before the 1950s. In fact, it was against Henry Ford. It must have been in the 1930s. That said that a corporation must have as its first value to show a profit.
It protect the shareholders. And I don't fault the shark or the corporation, but that's not what I called about.
Right.
Early in the hour, your guest was promoting this competition idea in the gas pricing.
Mm-hmm.
It's about as quaint as a Norman Rockwell painting. This doesn't exist anymore in America. These gas stations are all owned by big oil. You are buying your gas from ExxonMobil or Shell.
Right, and the few that have an independent name on them, maybe they own the pumps, but they're buying at wholesale from the same big oil companies.
Where are the independents? And I called earlier this week, the independents had been put out by that environmental law that the big oil pushed through that made them change their tanks.
Yeah.
And it put them all out. But they get a call. These owners get a call in the morning. It tells them what the price is going to be. If you talk to any of these owners, they'll tell you the story. Mm-hmm. And they get a call. They're told what to put up on the sign. And they don't even have control over how they manage their business. Out here in Manhattan Beach, there's a story last week about the guy who put up on his sign arm, leg, and firstborn for prices.
Right.
And but he did it in a kind of a protest, too, because he's been running a Shell station for 28 years, and he's getting out of the business because they told him they don't want him to have a mechanic or service bays. They want him to have one employee in a convenience store.
Right.
And, I mean, he can't even control his own business. So
right. Just jack up the profits and sell more oil, please.
Yeah.
More
so
gasoline.
This competition and gas pricing, and I've always heard this, it's the market forces. No, it's not.
Yeah. Well, it never is once you reach the point of monopoly. And that was the whole point of Senator Sherman's bill, was to save capitalism, not to harm it.
Exactly.
Dave, thanks for the call. A good point. Well made. Don in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hey, Don.
Hey, Tom. This whole thing about Republicans, I think the strategy to fight them in November, maybe we should go all out. You've been saying for a while that we should embrace trying to impeach Bush. Maybe we should fight Republicans bashing of Bush by embracing impeachment throughout the whole Democratic Party. And then before the elections, make Republicans put their money where their mouth is.
Back up Bush.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is the what you're describing is the corner that Republicans tried to paint Democrats into in the Clinton impeachment hearings.
Well, I think it would work, personally.
Yeah, I think as a political strategy it would work, too, but I doubt that the Democrats will do it. They don't have the bloodlust that the Republicans do.
Yeah, well, that's just all I had to say.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Don. Good comment and good idea. Sometimes I wish the Democrats had that bloodlust. Other times I'm really proud that they don't. Matt in El Dorado, California. Hey, Matt.
Hi. When I was in Montana back in the 90s, I went to towns all over the state, and any town you went into, every station, no matter what the make was, had the same price for gas. Exactly. Right. So I finally asked somebody coming from California, what's going on, because we have various prices. And they said it was by law. By law. And they required within a county, which means a town in Montana, that particular town would be fixed price.
Well, that's interesting.
And so, no, but like I was telling the screener, this just shows that they have always had this in their mind. You do it in Montana, who pays attention?
Right. So you think that this is like a test. This is how we figure out how we can control the markets.
Well, they're playing games, and they simply do a test area. And they were doing the same thing, in effect, in California, because they would take certain places like San Diego or San Francisco, raise the wholesale price. You don't fix the retail price. You fix the wholesale price.
Right.
And then it doesn't really matter much at the retail level because you can't move much for profit levels.
Right. Which
and
brings
so
us
the
back
fixed
to
pricing a... is going on constantly, and they'll do it in an area and then switch. And then an area that was higher before will be lower. In effect, they bleed in one area and then move and bleed the other area.
Yeah, which brings us back to the idea that if we simply started busting up, doing like the Republican president Teddy Roosevelt did or suggested, actually he did, trust busting, started just breaking up these companies and saying, sorry, you've gotten so big, you're dominating the marketplace, you're a trust. You shouldn't, no company should be controlling a product from its production through its retail, and no company should be controlling an entire marketplace or in a cartel with three other companies that control a marketplace. And we're gonna keep breaking them up until there's 50 oil companies in the United States, for example.
Well, there was one other thing. Here in San Francisco on Channel 4, a network station, they actually had a clip when they had the refiners convention, and it was the refiner, the head of Valero, that one. Mm-hmm. He actually stood up there and on mic, on camera, and they played it on and he said, we are going to milk this for the next couple of years. That's a quote.
Sure. Well,
on camera.
Surprise, surprise. Matt, thanks a lot for the call. It's, that's what they're doing. They are milking it. And that's us. It's not just us. It's our society. And perhaps most important, it's our democracy that's being milked. In our third hour, my friends, we're going to play a best-of program. I've got to go catch an airplane, but it's going to be one of our very best. You're going to love it. Thanks for being with us today, and we will see you next week. 57 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here, the place where smart people get their news. And remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on today's program in the second or third hour of our show here, don't miss Eric Burns from the TV show Fox Watch, showing up with his new book, which is actually a pretty reasonable book for a guy who's on Fox TV. It's called Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. Our quote for the day from Mark Twain: a banker is a fellow who lends you his umbrella when the sun is shining but wants it back the minute it begins to rain. Indeed. Paul Cameron's with us. He's with the Family Research Council, or Institute, FamilyResearchInst.org, the website. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I should note you are chairman of the Family Research Institute. And you folks just recently had published in Cambridge University's Journal of Biosocial Science a new study that concludes what?
Concludes that, guess what? Homosexuals have homosexual children. In fact, a bunch of them. Here is a strange thing. We live in a society in which obvious things, things that people would consider to be common sense, are disputed. In fact, you have professional associations like the American Psychological Association, the National Association of Social Workers saying, don't worry about it. Just because homosexuals raise children, the children will be no more apt to become homosexual. Hey, homosexuals come out of heterosexual homes, they come out of homosexual homes. But there's no overage here. We're talking about something that, after all, it's kind of born with people, so don't worry about it. Well, this study is the largest sample, 77 adults, not kiddies, these are adults, who are being interviewed because they had a homosexual parent. And in this particular instance, they were chosen by pro-homosexual investigators, three of them, three different studies. And they were trying to show that, really, it's pretty good to be, kind of fun to be the child of a homosexual. But if you looked at and assembled all the data that they published, it turns out for most of them, you could tell what kind of sexual activities and preferences they had. And it turns out 30% of them were, at the time of interview, engaged in or interested in homosexuality, 32% in heterosexuality, and the others, well, we just don't know. They didn't report.
Now, Paul Cameron, there's a value judgment implicit in what you're saying here and in the conclusion of your study, and that is that homosexuality is bad. I want to talk about your study in just a minute, but let's just assume for the moment that your study is right and that kids who grow up in a gay family are more likely to be gay. What's wrong with that?
Quite a bit. First of all, we're talking about a preference, a sexual preference. And
says you. Most scientists would say, Paul, you're a bigot.
Well, they might, but look at what...
Well, I will.
All right, that's fine. look at what homosexuals do. All the studies seem to agree that homosexuals, those who engage in homosexuality, are significantly more apt to be involved in criminality. Not associated with homosexuality.
I'm sorry, Paul. Last I looked, most of our jails are full of straight people.
That's true. That is, most people in jail are straight, if you would. But you'll find a very large minority, much more than the 2-ish% of the general population, who are in jail, who engage in, and both in jail and out of jail, in homosexuality. For women, it looks like it might even be at least a quarter of all female prisoners, And for men, certainly 10-15%.
Now, this is the same argument that was made about blacks back in the 1950s, about the reason why we should not allow blacks to integrate themselves into our society and we should keep them segregated, was because they were more likely to be criminal, they were less likely to have good educations, they were more likely to engage in behaviors that are outside the mainstream. I would submit to you, Paul Cameron, that if that is true, and again, I don't believe it, but if it were true, let's say for a moment, that it's the direct consequence of bigots like you running around trashing gay people.
Well, you could say that, but here's some of the other evidence. First of all, a lot of this is based on the CDC, National Household Survey of Drug Abuse study, the sample was drawn in 1996, so it's pretty fresh. We just published it last year, and lo and behold, those who engaged in homosexuality, both men and women, were about three times more apt to engage in the use of illegal drugs.
Yeah, this is the reefer madness argument made back in the 1920s. Oh, look out for that pot. It's used by those black people.
Well, you can say that,
I mean,
too,
if you trash a minority group, what do you expect them to do?
Well, go down the list. They're more apt to drive under the influence. My goodness, that's important because that can zap you or me if somebody is coming toward us on...
See, these are all arguments, in my mind, for mainstreaming people rather than marginalizing them, harassing them, calling them names, and arguing for legislation that further ostracizes them from society. I would say that your kind of bigoted behavior is what would produce these kinds of results predictably.
Well, unfortunately, they don't. For instance, if you look at blacks who are arguably still discriminated against, there are a lot of folk who don't particularly like blacks. The same study...
They show up disproportionately in our prison population.
Well, but blacks do not drive under the influence any more frequently than whites. And if you look at mental instability, blacks actually score a little bit better than whites.
On a per capita basis or in absolute numbers? Because blacks are much less likely than whites to own cars.
No, it's a per capita basis. And if you look at psychological disturbances, homosexuals
are about
twice as
bad. Paul, let's get back to your study. You claim that this is a study, but reading this thing, it appears to me that what you actually did is you went out and you bought three books from Amazon.com, two of which were profiles of gay kids who grew up in gay families. And you said, all three of them. And you said, oh, these three books are going to be the basis of my study. You didn't actually go out and get a random sample of people. You got three books from Amazon.com, and you wrote something up, and you call it a study based on that to justify your homophobia.
Well, you once again, saying that is not make it true. We already did a random sample. We already did a...
Oh, wait a second. What random sample? You mean a random sample of books?
No. This was done in 1983 and 84.
You did this?
Adolescence. And what we showed there was, out of 5,000 folk, 17 of these adults, these respondents, reported having had a homosexual parent. And of those, about a third also themselves were bi or homosexual. Now, that was based on a random sample, but, 17 people. Is that enough? It probably isn't. You know,
If you go over to WebMD and you look at the actual studies from 1981 to 1994, including 260 children reared by either heterosexual mothers or same-sex mothers after divorce, found no differences in intelligence, prevalence of psychiatric disorders, self-esteem, well-being, peer relationships, couple relationships, or parental stress.
Whose study is that?
This is the Ellen Perrin, professor of pediatrics at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston.
This was published
in the American Academy of Pediatrics and in the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Children growing up in same-sex parental households do not necessarily have differences in self-esteem, gender identity, or emotional problems from children growing up in parent homes. Now, you've got these real studies actually done by a major medical school, and then we've got you from the Family Research Institute coming out and actually getting press. I mean, actually in the mainstream media and being picked up by all these talk shows. You guys are out there, you know, sending out your press release saying, hey, we've got a real study. But you don't have a real study. You bought three books off Amazon.com and you said, oh, this will be our sample. And you wrote this thing up and you're using it to justify your fear of gays. I'm curious, Paul Cameron, why are you so afraid of gays?
Well, once again, I'm not afraid of them. But
are you insecure about your own sexuality? Do you have a small penis? What's the problem?
People who engage in homosexuality are similar to people who engage in smoking.
No, they're not.
Smokers as a whole
live
shorter lives, and smokers as a whole suffer and cause society to suffer somewhat. Those who engage in homosexuality suffer much shorter lives.
This is the same kind of bigoted crap that was being said about black people in the 50s. Don't you get this, Paul Cameron?
Well,
you're coming across like an incredible bigot.
What you seem to... You're just calling names. I'm trying to talk about data. So if we stick to the data and forget about name calling, I think you'll find I'm in pretty solid ground.
Okay, well, people can find out all about it over at familyresearchinst.org. Paul Cameron, chairman of the Family Research Institute, with his new study out. Paul, thanks for being with us today.
You bet.
It's good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Every time we think about same-sex parents, oh my gosh, we exclaim. I mean, to people who want to provide a protective and nurturing family environment, have they no shame? It's so deviant. It's the Lord's holy word, as my second wife said to my third. That a family's based on obligation and fear. We're defenders of marriage. Connubial narcs, ever vigilant and patriotic, patriarchs, defenders of marriage, defending the institution against people who want to get married.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, I blew a cork there. And I'm really debating this thing with myself. Maybe you can help me here. Those of you who listen to this program regularly know that we get all these news releases that go out to all the right-wing talk shows saying, hey, we've got a guest for you. It's so-and-so, and he's going to talk about ending the estate tax or whatever. And I put these people on the air just because I think it's so important for people to have an opportunity to hear a debate that is a rational debate where, the real issues get discussed and there's not any name-calling. And then I end up calling this guy a bigot. Now, here's the question. Am I engaging in name-calling? Is that, hitting below the belt? Or am I simply identifying bigotry? I think I'm identifying bigotry. I think I was probably over the top, and I owe Paul Cameron an apology when I asked him if, the motivation for his homophobia was having a small penis. That was over the limit, and Paul, I apologize for that. But this really does seem to me like being bigoted behavior. And in fact, Paul Cameron, one of the most prolific authors in the anti-gay arena, over at boxturtlebulletin.com, there's an article by Jim Burroway, B-U-R-R-O-W-A-Y, and you can probably Google it fairly easily, titled Paul Cameron Conquers Cambridge, in which Jim Burroway quotes Paul Cameron as describing AIDS as a, quote, godsend. He suggests that AIDS patients should be tattooed on their foreheads, and he was also quoted on at least two separate occasions that the idea of exterminating gays might come under consideration, although he denies endorsing the idea himself. Almost all of Cameron's work up to this point has been self-published, either on his website or on the pay-to-publish journal Psychological Reports. He refuses to acknowledge the possibility that the sexual orientation of most gay men and women is experienced as an intrinsic part of themselves. Instead, he speaks of being gay or transsexual as if those were conscious choices or beliefs. Sort of like becoming a smoker, right? Yeah, I think I'll decide to be a smoker. And he's taken the position that anything that results in gay children should be avoided at all costs. And then he notes that there is no obvious way to design a random sample of adult children of homosexual parents. Such children are not enumerated by any census, and how they might be contacted is obscure. Therefore, they did a sample of books on Amazon.com about people growing up in gay households and concluded from these books, which were about kids who grew up in gay households, that a lot of them grow up gay. But these were books that were essentially celebratory of being gay. And so, gee, if you pick these three particular books and you say, ah, we have 77 people in our sample, because those are 77 people who are profiled in these three books, now you could say, ah, 33% of people who grew up in gay households had turned out gay. Well, this is not science. I'm sorry, scientific literature is not based on sampling three books from Amazon.com. And besides that, these were all the biological children of LGBT parents. This has nothing to do with adoption, which is where the right wingers are going now. Let's make, let's trash gays. Let's ban gay adoption. I mean, it's over the top. Your thoughts on this. Richard in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
I just wanted to thank you for having Paul on and exposing the bigotry. He gets on a lot of the right-wing talk shows, and, of course, they build him up and prop up his bad science and all of that. Paul Cameron has been a thorn in my side ever since, back in the 80s. Through the fights of Amendment 2 in Colorado and, all of these things. I do think that, it helps, to have somebody of your stature, disclaiming his work. And, I just wanted to thank you for that. And I wanted to thank you for, the help that you're giving, to us in our fight for equal rights and the right to just live as normal citizens, which is what we are.
Indeed.
And I just wanted to thank you.
Well, thank you, Richard. I appreciate it. And thank you for your kind comments. I mean, we have gay members of our family. I have dear friends who are gay. This is not a lifestyle choice. There is something very real and something very biological here. And bigotry does harm gay people. It's just that simple. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom, we have about a minute.
Yeah, just a couple points. It is good that you expose these guys. But Randy Rhodes covered this thing, a study and a police blotter that showed anti-gay religious conservatives tend to be heterosexual pedophile predators. Proves nothing, right? Black guys, another study that serial killers tend to be white males. Does that prove all white males?
Right, right. And everybody in prison has eaten mashed potatoes at one point in the previous 2 years, or drank milk, right? Tom, thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Cowboys frequently secretly fond of each other. Say, what do you think all them saddles and boots was about? And there's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels for his brother. And inside every cowboy, there's a lady that'd love to slip out.
You tell him, Willie. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, coming up on 25 before. WebMD, I think, is a fairly, mainstream, credible source of medical information, and they actually do peer-review things. This article by Linda Little, WebMD Medical News, reviewed by Louise Chang, MD, published on WebMD.com, and reviewed by a medical doctor. Dateline Washington, D.C., October 12, 2005. Children growing up in same-sex parental households do not necessarily have differences in self-esteem, gender identity, or emotional problems from children growing up in heterosexual parent homes. Ellen C. Perrin, MD, professor of pediatrics at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston, says there are a lot of children with at least one gay or lesbian parent. She revealed the findings at the American Academy of Pediatrics conference and exhibition. Between 1 and 6 million children in the U.S. are being reared by committed lesbian or gay couples, she said. Children being raised by same-sex parents were either born to a heterosexual couple, adopted, or conceived through artificial insemination. She tells WebMD, the vast consensus of all the studies shows that children of same-sex parents do as well as children whose parents are heterosexual in every way. In some ways, children of same-sex parents may actually have advantages over other family structures. Researchers looked at information gleaned from 15 studies on more than 500 children, evaluating possible stigma, teasing and social isolation, adjustment and self-esteem, opposite gender role models, sexual orientation, and strengths. Studies from 1981 to 1994, including 260 children reared by either heterosexual mothers or same-sex mothers after divorce, found no differences in intelligence, type or prevalence of psychiatric disorders, self-esteem, well-being, peer relationships, couple relationships, or parental stress from the gay, the children raised in gay households. Some studies, as Perrin says, some studies showed that single heterosexual parents' children have actually more difficulty than children who are raised by parents of the same sex. They did better in discipline, self-esteem. These are the kids who are growing up in a gay household where there are two parents. These children did better in discipline, self-esteem, and had less psychosocial difficulties at home and at school than children of a single parent. So if anything, you want to go after something, go after single parenting if you want to look at the actual science. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jim in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Well, Tom, we've talked before, and I'm glad that you brought up the subject of this individual, Paul, what's his name's?
Cameron,
bad science, because, you know, first of all, let's start off where he's writing from. He's from the Family Research Council.
Institute, yeah.
Institute. Okay, this is a right-wing whack job bunch of people that can claim as part of their membership Mr. James Dobson. I would hesitate to call him doctor because here again is bad science. And his analogies that he used throughout his interview with you were terrible.
Yeah, but terrible. They play well on Fox News, you know.
Oh, well, they can play well anywhere they want, but as a reformed alcoholic, I can tell you that you can't say that alcoholic, you know, any certain group has a tendency to drink and drive more than another group. That's absolutely absurd.
Yeah. Well, there actually are some genetic variations that apparently predispose some people to alcoholism more than others, or at least so I understand. But that
may be so.
But I don't think that has anything to do with homosexuality.
If they bother to study the science behind alcoholism, getting a little off the subject, It has probably more to do with socioeconomic background than it has to do with genetics.
Yeah.
But you know, as far as I'm concerned, his science is absolutely terrible, and I'm glad you're exposing it.
Thank you, Jim. You're welcome, and thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Mike in Elk Grove, California. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yes, greetings to you, Tom. Thanks for having me. A great topic, and, you know, I appreciate having an opposition viewpoint as Mr. Cameron, who's, you know, has such reaching, you know, aspects of his argument. You know, two things I want to mention, because I attended, and this has, because they're picking on not only the gays, but, you know, now there's the immigrants, and that's usually the essence of these folks that come out when things are not going so well in the government. So I think,
or in society, let's say. Yeah.
Exactly. So in this case, I attended it's called a Day of Science, or Silence, excuse me, where the Sacramento Unified School District recognized gays, lesbians, transgenders to coexist without discrimination, harassment, and to be treated equally and fairly.
Whoa, I'll bet that brought the right-wing nutcases.
Oh, yeah, and that to me was something I think was written in the Civil Rights Code you know, back in the early 60s, give
or
take.
Well, except that the Civil Rights Code doesn't specify gender orientation.
Right. Now, what's interesting,
tragically.
Right, what's interesting, though, they forget about the Laramie Project and these crystal fascists. You know, that's they're just trying to energize their base again. You know, God, and I have this argument with coworkers all the time that think gays are just taking over.
Yeah.
But outside of that, I coached a young girl whose parents, you know, lesbians, and, you know, loving parents. They were very proactive in their children's activities. Mm-hmm. We got along really well. The first thing I always address the parents is, you know, we need to be fair. We need to, you know, in spite of one's orientation, whatever, they're not preaching on you, so you don't preach upon them. Mm-hmm. And this young girl was just an aspiring young girl, adult, and teaching tolerance and respect to others that are intolerant.
Yeah, and in fact, this is one of the points, Mike, thanks a lot for your comment and for making that. This is one of the points that is also made in this article over at WebMD by Linda Little. She says, two other large studies involving more than 100 couples found that same-sex parents, gay parents, also had contact with extended family, had social support, and had a more equitable division of labor in the home. As Ann Perrin said, lesbian couples, one of the researchers, an actual scientist, said, lesbian couples share household responsibilities and chores more equitably, and the children of lesbian couples are less aggressive, more nurturing to peers, more tolerant of diversity, and more inclined to play with both boys and girls' toys. End quote. Children seem to adjust better. Oh, she goes on to say, children seem to adjust better when there's a more equal division of labor in the home and the parental relationship with the children had a higher rating. The combined data presented by Perrin show that children whose parents are lesbian have no more problems than the rest of the children and actually may be more tolerant of differences. There was suggestive evidence that there were more stresses due to the gender of same-sex parents, but the children also reported greater well-being, more nurturing, and a greater tolerance for differences. What's striking, says Perrin, is that there are very consistent findings across these studies. They looked at a number of different studies done between 1981 and 1994, over 515 studies, over 500 children reared by gay parents, and you know that's what they came to the conclusion. No difference. If anything, these kids are more well-adjusted than kids growing up with single-parent families, with single straight parents. Michael in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Michael.
How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I have to say that I agree with you. You are not over the top with this guy. You treated him the way he should have been treated. Okay? There's nothing but bigots.
Okay. You know, so you don't think I was engaging in personal attacks?
Uh-huh.
Well, the question in my mind is, because we tell people when they come on this program, we tell them in advance, you know, when David books them, he says, Tom doesn't do personal attacks, we'll keep it to the facts. So the question is saying to somebody who you think is a bigot, calling them a bigot, is that a personal attack or is that a factual statement?
Well, you were speaking from the heart, okay? You were speaking what was on your mind. They're nothing but a bunch of religious right fanatics.
But see, I would say somebody who's really and truly religious would agree with Jesus that, you know, we shouldn't be let he who is without sin among you cast the first stone. And before you try and take the speck out of your neighbor's eye, look at the beam in your own eye and all those other, quaint sayings, are they? I still take them seriously.
Well, they're just people. They're just trying to get on with their lives, trying to live their lives. And you got people like this that are just trying to disrupt it. And it's just wrong.
Yeah.
It's not right.
Yeah. Okay. Michael, thank you very much. Good to hear from you.
Okay.
I appreciate
it.
Charles in Seattle. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I really appreciate your program, and I'm just amazed at the depth of your knowledge and all the facts and stuff you have. Anyway, what I wanted to tell you was I'm an 81-year-old retired veterinarian,
mm-hmm.
and I've heard comments, read comments from the homosexual community where they'll say that 10% of the population is homosexual, and I'll say the same thing for animals.
Mm-hmm.
The last 20 years I was in practice, I studied behavior extensively. I've read all kinds of books on the subject, read veterinary journals. I have never, ever seen an article referring to a homosexual dog, and I've never had a client come to me and say, hey, I think my dog is homosexual. And so I think they use the homosexual community uses this as sort of a illegitimate way to legitimize homosexuality. I just don't think it figures right.
Well, I remember two things. One, most recently, you know the Penguin movie?
I didn't see that.
There was this big movie about the penguins, right?
Well, yeah, it is, yeah. Sure,
it was
sure.
a big
yeah.
phenomenon.
Yeah.
Well, the guys who put that movie together afterwards were interviewed, and they said that one of the things that they cut from the movie, because they just didn't want it to be controversial, was the fact that when mom dies, the two males will take over. And take over the egg, and they're very affectionate towards each other. They become a gay couple. This is in Penguins, so you know.
Well, that's another thing that has always got me. Your screener said I could mention this if I had time. I object to the use of the word gay. Gay was a real wonderful word when I was young. You could a lot of
okay.
wonderful songs.
I got it. I got it. Charles, we are out of time. I'm not. It's not that I'm trying to cut you off. I appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I am a patriot, and I love my country, because my country is all I know. I want to be with my family, people who understand me. I've got nowhere else to go.
Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States. Joni in Evansville, Indiana. Hey, Joni, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great. What's up, Joni?
Well, I just wanted to call in. I am a lesbian, and I'm in a very wonderful relationship. We have children. We have a 20-year-old son and a 21-year-old daughter. And neither one of them happen to be gay. They're both in heterosexual relationships. And they're two of the greatest people I've ever known.
Yeah, and which, I mean, there's my two problems with this whole issue, frankly, and the fact that it's being flogged, is that even if this guy's research was right, that gay couples were more likely to produce gay children,
right.
It implies that there's something bad about that. That's like, you know, back in that now we're back to the argument back in the Tuskegee experiment days. You know, we shouldn't allow African Americans to reproduce because we don't want more of them in society. You know, that kind of thing, right?
Right.
It's like
exactly.
it's a bigoted premise to begin with, and then on top of that, it turns out when you actually read the study, it's based on bad science. It's not even
right.
based on any science at all. It's based on three books from Amazon.com.
Absolutely.
But I really
appreciate your show, and I appreciate you bringing this issue forward.
Thank you, Joni. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Robert in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Robert.
How you doing, Tom?
Great.
I was wondering, I'm all for gays having kids and all the gay rights could be. I'm perfectly a straight man. But I'm curious, how is the social situation for the children of gay parents within school, just around with their friends? Are there any studies on something like that, and how do they react when, you know, other kids come home and they got two moms or two dads? Is it a hard on them? We don't know anything about that. I'm just curious if there's anything we know about.
Well, in this Jim Burroway, in his article that's over at the BoxTurtleBulletin.com, his article, Paul Cameron Conquers Cambridge, he does cite a couple of studies that looked into that very question. And yes, some children of gay couples do experience harassment or discrimination at school.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to vary from community to community, within economic groups, within racial groups. And for some kids, it's a big deal. For some kids, it's not a big deal.
Right.
So, you know, I'd say probably where we're at right now with being the parents, being the children of a gay couple is not that different from where we were at 20 years ago, being the child of a biracial couple.
Right.
But that's just my guess. I mean, you know, that's
yeah,
not sensible what I'm saying here.
With I think it was the PBS special about a year ago. They were preaching tolerance for gay couples, and the Christian Coalition came down on them and said, you know, we don't want that on. I think it was PBS, or maybe it was SpongeBob, one of those old cartoon shows.
Yeah.
And it just seems they fight it every step of the way. And if we could start at a young age, we'd be in much better shape.
Yeah. There you go, Robert. Thanks
okay.
a lot. Good
Thank
to
you.
Hear from you, Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, speaking of bad science, your guest, if he generated any of his other numbers the way he came to his conclusions about the prison population being, about gays being more prone to crime, think about it. He goes to a prison where arguably most of the people you find there are criminals, and concludes that because there's a lot of homosexuality going on in that prison, that must mean that homosexuals tend to be prone to criminality. And I forget, it's too many years since I took the course, but there's a word in phileo that defines the fallacy that he's that he's committing there. It's maybe the transitivity or something. He's arguing backwards. You would expect to find people that possibly would never have had an interest in the same
sex relationship. In science, it's called sample bias. It's a study contaminated by sample bias.
Yeah, so but, wanted to toss that in. If he's using that kind of logic in the rest of his so-called study there, it would be a highly suspect conclusion.
Yeah, good one, Jim. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Good to hear from you. Harvey in New York City. Hey, Harvey.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
Okay. Years ago, I read an article in Scientific American. It was about population pressure. And what they study did was it put a lot of mice in an environment in which there was a lot of food, but limited space.
Right. And as the population increased, the incidence of homosexuality increased.
Homosexuality started among the mice.
Right. I remember that from college psychology class.
Okay.
I thought it was
so
rats,
I remember mice. It could be rats. But there is documented data that homosexuality does occur in other species.
Sure. It occurs biologically, and it may be a consequence of population pressure. And when I was a kid in the 1960s, there were 3 billion people on the earth. There's 6 billion people today. Maybe that has something to do with it. Who knows? Oh,
yeah, I know. Okay, but that's what I brought up. Okay.
Yep. Okay. Thanks a lot, Harvey. Good to hear from you. Joe in Secaucus, New Jersey. Hey, Joe, we have a little less than a minute left. What's up?
Well, Tom, first of all, I just want to thank you for your program. I am a gay guy, and I don't think that you are bigoted in any way. If someone holds a belief that is bigoted, it's not inappropriate to say that. That could be a very affable person. It could be a very friendly guy. But, you know, there are people in this world who could say they feel that an interracial relationship is wrong, that children are better off with. They honestly feel that the parents should be of the same race. They could have biblical children.
And if somebody says that to me, I would call them a bigot also.
Of course.
Yeah.
But they could be a very nice person.
Yeah.
And also what I wanted to say to you is that all of us, gays and lesbians, every single one I know of, came from a straight relationship.
Yeah, there you go. The vast majority of people out there did. It's Glenn, thank you. Or excuse me, Joe, thank you very much.
Good to
hear from you. I appreciate the call, and thank you for your kind words. Coming up next, Eric Burns from Fox News Watch. Yeah, he's a host on Fox TV. We're the founding fathers, the original shock jocks. Find out. We'll get back with that in just a moment. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Stick around, my friends. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives.